be rolled over to another day, so that will not be worked today. We're going to proceed with
2909.
We'll proceed with public hearing on 2334 first, and then a work session on 2737, and then proceed with public hearing on 3407, and then be proceeding further down the agenda. But we have to discipline our time because I'm told that we're going to lose a substantial portion of our committee at 10 o'clock. So we need to get a lot of ground covered between now and 10 o'clock.
I don't have staff here ready enough to tell me what's going on.
Okay. I guess that I'm going to change the order then, because our lead witness on 2334 is not in the room. So I'm going to adjust our timing then, because we do have Representative Nelson here. So I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3176. Representative Nelson, or Council Stanford, first will introduce it, and then
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 3176 requires a motor vehicle telematic service provider to provide to a law enforcement agency, if the agency so requests, the location of a motor vehicle. It allows a law enforcement agency to request this information if the agency has probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed and that locating a motor vehicle will assist in the investigation of the crime. It allows the Attorney General to impose a yet-to-be-determined civil penalty against a provider for failing to provide law enforcement with the requested information. A little bit more background. Through the use of global positioning system satellites and cellular technology, the location of motor vehicles can be readily determined. What's often more difficult to determine is the legal authority of law enforcement in obtaining from a company that tracks the vehicle's location to get the location of the vehicle, even if ascertaining the location of the vehicle would help solve a crime. And that's what House Bill 3176 seeks to address.
Very good. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of this distinguished committee. I'm State Representative Donna Nelson, fourth term from District 24. And with me I have...
Jay Gregory.
From
Los Angeles, California.
Thank you. This is a great, great bill today. This is House Bill 3176, and I would call your attention that to this bill we have now the proposed amendment that seems to fit every critique we've gotten, and we hope we'll be able to move the bill with this amendment, the dash two, today, if at all possible. I just would like to say that a few Christmases ago, in our community, lost were two young men. It was Christmas Eve, and the day was very important for one of the young men because he had an arm that had no feeling in it, the result of a skiing accident. And the day after Christmas, he was to be in California, San Francisco, for specialized surgery. We could not find those two boys. Thanks to some help on the next day, on Christmas Day, where we all spent numerous hours searching for these two young men who had gotten snowed in on a mountain, with the help of a helicopter and numerous individuals on horses, we did find these young men. However, had we had Dalton's Law, this bill in place, we would have found them, and perhaps we'd all enjoyed Christmas much better. Also, there's an individual here, Representative Krieger, who will recall that in our first session we passed a bill for a grandmother. And the story was that the grandson, or her granddaughter, had been kidnapped by a father and ultimately taken to Canada and had not been seen in 4 years. We passed a bill that would allow an individual who was had reason to suspect a spouse might leave with a child illegally, could require a $200,000 bond. We passed that. Had we had Dalton's Law in effect, we could have countered the action of this spouse, and perhaps that grandmother would have seen that granddaughter one more time before she passed away that year. We've had many incidents like that, most recently the Kim incident that is very close to our hearts and on our minds. And had this bill been in effect, it more than likely could have played a part in saving Mr. Kim's life as well as his family. I'd like to read very briefly the letter from the mother of Dalton Robertson, and this will tell you the story and the reason this law is brought forward today. The letter is addressed to me, and it says, "Dear Representative Nelson, Oregon House Bill 3176 is referred to as Dalton's Law in memory of my son, Dalton Robertson, who died in 2005. He was missing for 5 days with his brand new car, which was equipped with a vehicle location device, but the sheriff's office was not permitted to use the service to find the vehicle and locate Dalton. After 5 days, they found my son, but it was too late. Mother to mother, thank you, Representative Nelson, for sponsoring House Bill 3176. There are numerous common sense reasons to support this bill, Dalton's Law. It will save time, energy, and the resources of law enforcement. It will find missing persons, carjacking victims, or the lost and disoriented elderly. Use of Dalton's Law can lower the dangers of high-speed police chases, aid in search and rescue missions, and quickly solve Amber Alerts. But the greatest gift of Dalton's Law is sparing a mother the frustration and anguish of knowing there is a way to immediately locate her son who's in imminent danger, but law enforcement is not being allowed to utilize it, so the family must wait. Wait and fear. Wait and cry. Wait and beg again for help. Wait until it's too late. House Bill 3176, Dalton's Law, will not only save lives, it will save mothers and brothers and cousins and spouses from that terrible wait. This is signed, sincerely yours, Ann Robertson." You have this in your packet before you. Also in the packet, and I won't read the letter, is a letter from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And they tell us that a recent study found that in 76% of the child abduction homicide cases, the child is killed within the first 3 hours after the abduction. Clearly, time is the enemy in these cases. Even a short delay in getting information to law enforcement could result in tragedy. The data they have shows that 70% of attempted child abductions involve a suspect driving a vehicle. Information about the location of a vehicle could prove vital. One more reason for this, a vital sign, and you have this in your package.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Nelson. Mr. Gregory.
Thank you, Chairman McPherson. Dalton Robertson was my friend. I went through that time in 2005 with his mother and his other friends. I provided written testimony, so I'm not going to read it because I want you all to be able to get to the rest of your agenda. But I do want to point out that in there is a letter from John Walsh, host of TV's America's Most Wanted, whose son Adam was kidnapped and murdered. Years ago, he says that he recognizes that every minute counts when trying to find missing persons. Oregon House Bill 3176 saves time, saves the resources of law enforcement, and saves lives, and he supports Dalton's Law. Now, I don't want you to spend too much time thinking about Dalton anymore. I want you to think about the next person. I want you to think about the grandparents or the kidnapped child or the carjacking victim, because we know, unfortunately, it's going to happen again, and we need to have our law enforcement to be able to save these people's lives. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gregory.
Chair McPherson, I just want to say that what was unfortunate in this case is that there was no one with the authority to activate the system in a brand new car, which Dalton Robertson was in. So while all vehicles are not equipped with LoJack or OnStar, the majority of the new vehicles today are. Hopefully, this bill will save numerous lives and prevent horrendous crimes. I thank you for your time, and we'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Representative. And committee members, we have somebody from DOJ here who can explain the Dash 2 amendments, and so I think it might be helpful to go to that person, unless there's something really you need to ask of this panel.
Just a quick question. I heard reference to Mr. Kim's situation, that he would have been saved if we had this law. Is that what I heard?
He could have been, had he had a vehicle tracking system like this in his vehicle. Yes, he could have been with this law.
Okay. But he didn't have a tracking
right.
system.
Right, and that's why I said Representative, Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, it possibly could have saved his life had his car been equipped.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank Representative Nelson and Jay for bringing this, and they've done a good job of preparing us and having meetings up front so we can save time.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Nelson and Mr. Gregory. Mr. Slauson, why don't you come up and we'll excuse this panel here, and we'll...
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Michael Slauson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Justice, assigned to the Organized Crime Section. I'll just talk briefly about what the changes the Dash 2 amendments do to the bill. In the previous bill, there was an issue raised about whether or not it would satisfy our Article 1, Section 9, our constitutional requirements with respect to search and seizure. There is a Oregon Supreme Court case, State versus Campbell, that says law enforcement cannot use a tracking device to trace the location of a vehicle just with probable cause of a crime. You have to fall into one of the exceptions of the search warrant requirements. So what we've done here in these Dash 2 amendments is to try to codify what the court said we could do as exceptions to search warrant requirements. So the first one would be what we kind of refer to as a true emergency exception to search warrant requirement. And this is a restatement of what we already have in our statutes under community caretaking. The second portion, which gets us outside of the scope of Campbell here, talks about having probable cause to believe a crime has been, is being committed, or is about to be committed, and requires an exigency. That was what was missing in the Campbell case, and the court very specifically said that if you have an probable cause and exigency, law enforcement can lawfully track a vehicle. The other thing I'd like to mention right now, we have statutory requirements with respect to getting a warrant for a tracking device. So in the event that there are not exigent circumstances, so law enforcement is unable to use this as a tool, Dalton's Law as a tool, there is a statutory mechanism for getting a warrant to do that tracking.
Okay. And I've noticed, Mr. Slauson, that the first condition in the Dash 2 is the owner of the vehicle consents to the request. So I'm trying to understand if what if the vehicle disappears with the owner inside of it, then how would that request come about?
Well, I suppose, Chair McPherson, if you have, that might not be available, right, in some circumstances if the owner is unavailable, but maybe the owner, if you have an OnStar program or something, says, I'm completely lost, or I'm out in the middle of nowhere, I don't know where I'm at, can you notify law enforcement to my whereabouts so I can be found? Be one way.
Mr. Chair?
Okay, Representative Flores.
Thank you. As a follow-up to that, Mr. Slauson, the sub A under sub 2 on the Dash 2 amendments, again, the owner of the vehicle consents to the request. Is that a standalone provision, or is it have to be in conjunction with sub A, B, and C? All of those criteria have to be met.
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, in response to your question, no, that would be an independent basis, which is that is a constitutional basis as well.
I was misreading it. Yeah, it isn't. I was seeing an and further down, but that's in a sub under C. So if consent is one ground, and then but B and C, lowercase C, are independent bases. I was misreading it.
So that is one provision, or B or C.
Yes. Correct.
Okay. Okay, any further questions, Mr. Slauson?
What's the bill?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Slauson. I'm going to add, there are three other people who wanted to speak, and I'm going to invite them all up at once. I don't know what the perspective on the bill is, but we do need to move through this. So Andrea Meyer, Amy Alkonich, and Roger Tracy. I invite you all up together. And they actually signed up in the order I just read, that is Ms. Meyer, Ms. Alkonich, and Mr. Tracy. Okay.
That's okay.
Thank you. I understand your time constraints. Roger Tracy, it was on the news Monday night that there are 18 million college students in the United States, and depression is at an all-time high. There are over 230,000 suicide attempts each year. That's 634 suicide attempts every day among college students in the United States. A lot of that depression is caused by the onslaught of the news. They're very efficient in bringing us bad news 24/7. And this law is the life-saving tourniquet that is needed in an emergency situation for a wounded society. It will save a lot of lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tracy. Ms. Alkonich.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Amy Alkonich. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I intended to come in here and oppose this bill, but I just got the -2 amendments, and I haven't fully had time to process them, and I just read the Campbell case, which is the case that Mr. Slauson was talking about in terms of the constitutionality. In looking at this in 35 seconds, I think that most of the issues have been addressed for me. My one concern is that on the -2 amendments, lines 4 to lines 10, that I think they're still a little broad in terms of the crossover they'll have with lines 11, section C, A, B, and C. I haven't had fully time to process this, but my concern is that some of these issues, like life-threatening emergencies, preventing serious harm to a person, can also cross over to the issue of law enforcement, and I'm not sure exactly how, and I'm assuming that the police will do a good job in, you know, parsing this out, but I'm not exactly sure how you're able to separate somebody preventing serious harm to another person and the commission of a crime. So I'm concerned that this section is a little bit too broad. There's a little bit too much crossover, and to give it such an exception to the warrant requirement makes me uncomfortable. Again, I haven't had fully time to process this, but that's my main issue. I really, OCDLA encourages the purpose of this bill. We're happy to sit down with Mr. Slauson and see if we can tighten up that language. We just got these amendments, or else we would have done that sooner. We definitely appreciate and think it's a real positive what they've done with the law enforcement agency portion. We think that's a huge step towards making this constitutional, but that is the section we have concern about. And I don't exactly know quite how to fix it within the short time period I've had to process it, but I think it can be fixed. So
we're going to give you a little more time for that, so let's hear from Ms. Meyer.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the, ACLU of Oregon. Today, I apologize, a little bit of jet lag. I, too, was intending to come in here in opposition to the original bill. I still have concerns. I still have also not had an opportunity to fully evaluate this. In general, we think that the law enforcement should have the tools when there's exigent or emergency circumstances. We just think that there is and should be the need to get a court order to have that judicial oversight to ensure that our law enforcement is not doing things that we don't want them to do. I'm distressed by the case where I believe Representative Nelson talked about 5 days elapsing and law enforcement not responding. I would have hoped that there would be an easy ability to prove probable cause and get a court order when something like that is going on, and that's what we expect. So we are talking about exceptions. We're talking about some degrees, the probable cause element under exigent circumstances, under the lower sections, 11 onward, consistent with OCDLA. We are concerned with the language in the first part, concerned with the tying about may request, but there's civil penalties to the company if they don't. So we would also be more than happy to work with DOJ and other stakeholders to see if we can get this in a narrow way and, you know, continue to look for, if they don't get a court order, how can there at least be court oversight after the fact? I mean, we know sometimes when law enforcement, the FBI and federal, we've got the history recently with where they have a power and they don't have judicial oversight, that it can be used beyond the means that I think everyone expected in the legislative body. But by having the judicial oversight even later, it provides checks and balances to make sure they're doing exactly what you want them to do. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Meyer. That concludes the people who are signed up. What I'm going to do is close the public hearing on House Bill 3176, not go immediately to work session, and what I would ask for those people who have just received these amendments is to take this time now to study these, have conversations with Mr. Slauson. If we're in a position to bring it back to a work session later today and we have time to do it, we may do that, but we also may have to roll it over to add to an already very crowded agenda tomorrow. So if you could be prepared as you can be for action later today, that would be helpful.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3176.
Yeah, Darren was on the phone when I was in the office. So he was talking, I told him the bill was on the next.
Okay, we're reshuffling the order of action here based on who's available to present. So we're going to go next to a public hearing on House Bill 3407. I'll open that public hearing now. Council Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3407 exempts and disclosure of the public safety officer requests the name and home address of the public safety officer contained in the voter registration records, the name of the public safety officer contained in county real property assessment or taxation records, so long as the public safety officer previously requested that his or her name not be released as it relates to a particular piece of property, applies only to real property assessment records that may be made immediately available to the public, allows disclosure of public safety officers' email address. Kim. Chairman of the committee, that's the bill. It comes to you from Representative Galizio.
We have a panel of three people to come and present initially on this. Brian DeLashmet, Tom Gallagher, and Paul Snyder. And to those who are presenting, or they're coming forward, we would invite comments on the relationship between this bill, 3407, and a bill that's also on the agenda for work session for today, 2847, because there's a interconnection or overlapping subject matter. Gentlemen.
For the record, Brian DeLashmet, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, and the Oregon State Police Officers Association. I've handed out written testimony, but just let me just summarize. This bill was introduced on our behalf without knowing that there was going to be another bill that was dealing with PAs. As you recall, those members that were on the committee last time, and I'm looking around, I think there was at least three. There was a bill passed last session. It was 2724. And in its simplest form, what it basically attempted to do was block by the county clerk the release of a public safety officer's address if somebody were to call up. And we had two officers that came in and testified. And the one officer I'll summarize, and some of you I know that the chair, Representative Barker, and Representative Krieger were on the committee at that time. The officer's testimony basically was that he made a stop in the morning of a citizen. The citizen was cited for failure to use a seat belt, which is a relatively minor offense. The citizen got very irate, got, of course, his name, was able then to directly call the county clerk's office and say, does John Doe own property in this county? The county clerk's office says yes, and he said, well, what is the address? He got the address, and by the time that officer got home that night, on the front door of his house was a letter addressed to him basically saying, I know where you live. I know where your children go to school. You are no longer safe. And that is just one of a number of cases that we've had come before us. So we passed 2724, and my recollection is it came out of committee unanimously, passed the floor, both chambers unanimously. In the process, there was a couple of amendments, one brought by the county clerks and the Association of Oregon Counties that has now backfired on us in some of the counties. And let me say what I think the two remaining issues are. The counties came to us during the interim and said, we would just as soon have the ability to track the property by the address and block the name. So the scenario that would happen is if somebody called and said, I want to know if John Doe owns property, then it would show, in fact, that that was a redacted name. It would show basically blank, that's a blocked name, rather than the linkage being the other way around. And we said, fine. My understanding is that a number of the counties, the way that their computer systems run, in fact, all the counties, they, in fact, track property by the address. So they requested that. The piece on our side that we had a problem with was that an amendment that was offered and accepted on the other side, which we thought we knew what it meant, and I think the counties knew what it meant, which was property and liens, was in fact interpreted by some of the county councils and some of the counties that if in fact a tax record, they saw that as a property record, and therefore they didn't have to block any of this information at all. And we saw that as going back into an old mortgage, an old lien, something in the microfiche, that they didn't have to go back and redact all that information out, block it. And all we wanted was the blockage on the front end of the tax and assessment records. So this bill is in front of you. It was the product of about a six-month working group between us, the counties, the county assessors. You have it in front of you now. The problem is now that we thought we had an agreement. The other side has backed away and wants to go a different direction. So I would lay the policy discussion on your table. Is it the proper thing to do to try and protect those public safety officers? We have absolutely no problem with this being combined with the DA's bill. I think it's a smart thing to do. Then we have one process. Everybody knows what the process is. We all have the same protection. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
Let's hear from the rest of this first panel here before we open for questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association, and I have some comments on the bill. Basically, we're neutral, but I think there are some issues I see in the bill. First off, we really have no objection to protecting police officers, safety officers, and even to that extent, trial attorneys, district attorneys, and DOJ people that are involved in the front line. It is not good public policy to put anybody or their family at risk. So fundamentally, we're not opposed there. I'll make the following comments on both bills. Number one, you're putting this in 191.502 as opposed to 191.501. Yes. 191.502 is an absolute exclusion. You can never get at the record. In 501, there's a balancing test which you go to the Department of Justice if you're at the state, or to the DA if you're in a local government, and request the records, and they will balance the public policy between releasing the record or not releasing the record. So we generally prefer, when we make these exceptions, to have them in 501. That's a policy decision you have to make. Number two, the definition of public safety officers is fairly broad, and we see ourselves in some extent, along with local government, I mean other government supporters, as protecting the public records, a public right to know. And so when we get to these exemptions, we look at them and say, protect people. But there should be some evidence as to who and what needs to be protected. So at some point in time, we need to go back and take a look at that using a statutory reference to all public safety officers and see if everybody who's exempted from that is under the same scrutiny. The third thing I'd say is, why every public record? If somebody as a DA or police officer makes business investments, they own rental property, they are in other situations, it seems like that that goes a little too far to exempt every piece of property that they have. Their personal addresses, their residence, the people that need to be protected, that's the sort of thing. But if you own an apartment building or something, there are other commercial reasons and other reasons why you want to know what is on the public record and what is owned. My fourth point here is that, and I think they did it for a very good reason, but it's you request to exempt your name and your addresses and so forth. I personally think that we really should, if the public policy is right, we should exempt this personal information of safety officers and DAs. It shouldn't be something they have to go forward and request and so forth. That may seem backward, but I think that will facilitate the clarity of who's on and who's off. It won't make it the personal responsibility of each individual, because there already is a section of the public record laws that allows an individual to exempt his name and address and so forth. It doesn't go far enough, which is why you have this bill. So in general, we're supportive of these exemptions. We think there are some pieces of these bills that can be fixed better from the public records aspect, not from the personal safety aspect. You may have to let the bill go forward as it is, and we would look to, in that case, working with the sponsors to fix it on the Senate side rather than trying to do that here, because I know the timeline. The last thing I want to say is we're seeing more and more public records requests for public officials to exempt all of their personal information. I saw one bill that has veterinarians needing to be exempted. I think we need to work in the interim to find a process for doing this that is not legislative, a way for people who have a security or safety issue to be able to go through some sort of a public records process and do this administratively rather than legally. So I would look forward to working with the parties and perhaps with the interim committee to find some way to do that, so you're not facing 10 or 15 bills a session, which you go through some fairly difficult weighing and decision-making process. This seems administrative. Thank you.
Mr. Snyder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. I'd like to just go back to Mr. DeLashman's testimony and add a few things, one of which is to say that we did have a work group. And I was personally very impressed by the extent to which Mr. DeLashman's clients worked with us to try to mitigate the cost to the counties and come up with identifying and articulating exactly which records are the ones that were needed to be redacted or exempted from disclosure. And we worked together on this issue for several months, and everybody worked in good faith. Unfortunately, when we finally reached a point where we thought we had everything covered, we would send the proposal out to assessors and tax collectors and others and then get information back that says, no, this still won't work, and here's another problem, and here's another problem. So, regrettably, AOC is at the point right now where we don't support House Bill 3407, although we do very much appreciate the work of the proponents. And we acknowledge right here that it's a much improved version of what the law should be in terms of mitigating the costs and focusing on the records that are the ones that are the greatest concern. The problems that you'll hear, I think, from assessors and tax collectors in another panel relates to the cost, relates to the benefit. The cost for assessors and tax collectors is high. The benefit they are concerned is minimal, because the information is probably available on the Internet anyway. Other issues have to do with their view that this represents a crack in the dike, and I think other legislation and amendments that you're going to see in other bills is evidence of that. That basically we start with public safety officers, and then we add deputy district attorneys, and then we add assistant attorneys general. Perhaps with Senate Bill 493, we might be adding health care providers and the veterinarians, and after a while, each one of these records gets redacted, and there's another hole in the public records law upon which businesses and other folks rely. And that's why we would recommend to you that regardless of what happens to these bills, that some work be created during the interim to have a global review of the costs and the benefits and the unintended consequences that might result from just adding more and more layers of people. Having said that, I also want to emphasize that public safety officers are Mr. DeLashman's clients, but they're also our employees. And so are the deputy district attorneys. And we have no intent to have our employees put in jeopardy because of the availability of records to miscreants. We share a common goal with respect to this legislation, and we just as much like to see it resolved in a way that takes care of this issue as anybody else would. Unfortunately, from our perspective, we're still not quite there, and I would echo Mr. Gallagher's recommendation that if the bills come out, and perhaps that should be the case, that we should work further with the proponents to see if we can make some more advances in that regard.
Okay. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. You know, I'm very sensitive to this issue, and Representative Barker and I figured out how to avoid it, and that's being so obnoxious that nobody ever wants to find you. But really, if you recall, when we were at the Aloha High School, on the online predators, children, they just had the first name of the girl on the internet that the chat's taking place with. But he knows the town from that. He knows her age. That got him to the school, to the brother, to the father, their home address. I think with the technology that's there today, irregardless of what we do, anyone that can get on a computer in a few minutes is going to be able to find your home address. It's out in so many forms, so many places. Go on online now and look up your own name, and you'd be surprised what's there and how many different places. There's hundreds of them that I can find my name on and my address. So I realize what we're trying to do, and I don't object to that, but I just don't think in today's world that we can get there at a huge expense at the county level. I don't know if that's warranted, because if someone really wants to come after you, you know, they're going to come after you.
Representative McPherson, or Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, my members do realize that there are other methods. What we were attempting to do last session and this session is just not make it so easy by utilizing a public body to get that information. If I may actually make two comments that I've heard. One is the definition of public safety officers versus law enforcement. For us, this could happen in a corrections setting. It could be a Department of Corrections in which the inmate inside calls a friend outside and says, by the way, this DA employee or this DOC employee is giving me a bad time. Why don't you go rough up his wife or scare his wife and his children? So we're open to a broader discussion, but we don't want to make it so confined that it's just a police officer only. There are parole and probation officers and a number of others that have that same need. As to the request versus the automatic that was mentioned, why don't we just make it automatic for all police officers or all law enforcement officers or public safety officers? Actually, our response was that would be great, but the response from the counties is they don't know who those people are to automatically do it. So when somebody pays their taxes or is on the tax or assessment roll, it doesn't say police officer Joe Smith. It says Joe Smith or Joe and Joanna Smith. So a way for us to help them was if they wanted to have that blocked is just to have a form and submit the form and say, I want to have it blocked. So thank you.
Just briefly here, because we've got several other people signed up.
Yes,
on this
I will be very brief. Thank you, Chair McPherson. And I just have one or two questions. But on page 5 of the original bill, and it talked about this in the original summary about the voter registration cards. And I just want to open up another Pandora's box and just to say I really agree with Mr. Gallagher that this is an issue that ought to be looked at thoroughly and out of session. I mean, there are so many variables now, from internet predators to the fact that I have a constituent that we actually wrote a bill because he walked into our Marion County elections office and for a mere $35 got thousands and thousands of names of voter information with no request to see his identification or what purpose he was going to use those names for. He found it very astounding. And so I just think there's a whole lot bigger. There's just lots of little things bubbling around this, a public access for information. And I don't know if we can protect ourselves or not.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Let me excuse this panel here.
Chair, may I just make a quick request of Mr. Gallagher?
Go ahead.
You had indicated that this would better be placed under 192.501 than 192.502, and perhaps offline you could talk to me about that, because it looks as if when the bill was modified in 2005, all of 192.501 will not come into effect until January 2010, as it says here. So there's current statute in place, and whatever was done in 05 isn't effective until 2010. So maybe you could bring that, and we can have a conversation.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just one quick comment. I think we passed a bill on the House floor that allowed a person without an address to register to vote, which means their ballot would come to the
elections office.
So something that I thought was kind of interesting, and maybe if I was a police officer, I might do that.
Okay. Well, I'd like to invite Kevin Neely and Pete Shepard forward together, because I think they may help us understand these issues a little more fully, and also the connection to the other bill that relates to Deputy District Attorneys 2047. And I'll let you gentlemen choose what you think would be the more useful order of presentation.
Members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely, Oregon District Attorneys Association. And I don't want to take a lot of your time, but I wanted to read one paragraph of an email that I've gotten since last I addressed the committee on this issue, because I think it's a really important, it really characterizes the what's happening out in the world of district attorneys. And so, just a second, it's warming up. So this is from the chief deputy in Lane County. One of our DDAs was recently alerted to a well-planned attempt to kill him and his family. The involved inmate is a serious player who's been a long stretch in federal custody for bank robbery. Finding the DA was an easy 10-minute exercise. The inmate strolled over to the public access computer in the county building, selected property record search, typed the DA's name into the system, and was immediately rewarded with the DA's home address. Anybody who wanted to locate you and your family could do the same thing. The inmate subsequently went to the DA's home, cased the place, and developed a plan to fill a pressurized home and garden sprayer with kerosene, which he planned to spray all over the underside of the house and crawl space. He planned to ignite the kerosene and then wait across the street with a deer rifle to shoot the DA and each of his family members as they fled from the fire. The inmate was arrested during a burglary of the pawn shop in which he was attempting to steal the rifle he planned to use. His cellmate later gave up his plan after he was unable to live with the idea of the whole DA's family being slaughtered. Under existing law, there's no exemption allowing for the exclusion of DA law enforcement property records. I got this email 2 days after we had our last hearing, and I think it really gives a stark reality what's happening to these DAs. What we've done is, in the course of the development of this bill, is I've talked to a number of the county recorders, and in many of those counties, the recorders already have a form that they use independent of any state activity that the individual law enforcement officer or person who has some sort of public safety concern can fill out and turn in. And in the course of doing that, the information that follows their name that identifies their resident address gets removed or not displayed. It's not removed. It's just not available to the public in the public presentations of material, in their online presentations of material. That's the core issue here. And I think Representative Krieger, he brought up an interesting point, and that is this stuff is often accessible in other ways on the Internet. But again, I think that what often happens is that information is originally posted on the Internet through some county record process. They post the property records. They post these things online. I think you'll hear from the folks in the counties. They're increasingly doing that. And then data miners come in, suck all that data out, and transfer it onto private web pages. And so if we can get at that core private or core public record, hopefully it will decrease the ability of data miners to go out there and get all that other data. So I apologize. We don't have amendments back that we're seeking on 2847. I expect them any time now. I got calls on them yesterday. I know they're working on them. And what we're seeking to do in those amendments is create a form inside the public records law. It's a simple four-line form that we would expect the district attorney's office or the law enforcement office, the actual office manager, when you hired a new employee, would fill out that form, and it directs the law enforcement officer to submit that form to the county clerk, the county tax assessor, the city recorder, and the Secretary of State's office. And then the Secretary of State, those four bodies could at least take the initial exercise in seeking to ensure that the personal information about the residence of those employees is not disclosed. We've also taken the added step of not just excluding the name and the address. As the recorders have told us and the county administrators have told us, that doesn't prevent people from figuring out where you live. They can look up the plat. There's a whole bunch of ways they can do that. So in our amendments, what we'll seek to do is just essentially say any information that might be reasonably used to identify the residence address of the individual shall not be released to the public, shall be exempt from public records disclosure. I expect to have those amendments back. I apologize they're not back quite yet. And we're perfectly comfortable, the District Attorney's Association is perfectly comfortable and thinks it's perfectly appropriate to include the law enforcement officers and the individuals at the Department of Justice who perform the prosecutorial function in the same manner that the district attorneys do. Again, we're hopeful that the committee will take a close look at those and pass those, and keep in mind that right now, this is the second such episode we've had in the past 2 years, and 4 years ago in Crook County, the deputy district attorney's house actually did get lit on fire by a disgruntled individual who had been prosecuted. It's high time we do this. We're perfectly happy to work on this in the interim, but there's absolutely no reason that we should jeopardize the lives of any more deputy district attorneys in the course of the next 2 years as we try to find a better solution, because there probably is a better solution. But in the meantime, we need to make sure this information is protected as much as we can, and we should never balance the challenges, that the administrative challenges that this is going to cause for custodians of public records. I've been a custodian of public records. I know there are administrative challenges, but those should never outweigh our responsibility to protect the lives of the family members and the individuals who are the backbone of our criminal justice system. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Neely. Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. If you choose to amend House Bill 2847 to protect records concerning the residential addresses of deputy district attorneys, we ask that you consider adding also to the same extent protections for Assistant Attorneys General employed by the Department of Justice. I might argue that in seeking to protect children from meth-addicted parents, lawyers in the Department of Justice's family law section prosecuting termination of parental rights cases are going face-to-face with the very same people that deputy DAs are prosecuting in another courtroom just down the hallway. Or I could tell you that assistant attorneys general in our defense of criminal convictions program pick up where those same deputy district attorneys end off, and again face-to-face with the same defendants on the same charges, defending the same convictions that those deputy district attorneys have obtained. I could suggest to you that the colleagues in the criminal justice division who prosecute defendants whose well-engineered illicit organizations are generating a criminal momentum that arguably is more dangerous than an individual defendant might well face the very same kind of retribution and even a higher risk of retribution from the defendants that they are prosecuting. I could argue those things to you, but I think that they really kind of sound like mere special pleading if they weren't connected to the same underlying systemic concern. I think this goes to what I would suggest to you as the core policy question here, and that is that the threat that's posed by retribution aimed at the state's lawyers in all of these different functions is ultimately a threat that's aimed at the integrity of the prosecution function. It is a threat that's carried out by defendants who, however inarticulately, are trying to influence the course of the prosecution of that individual defendant. And even where they seek retribution after the fact, the effect of that could be to have an effect on the future, the prosecution of the next case, and the vigor and the desire of the state's lawyers to take up this important calling of prosecution, both in a civil and criminal context. I agree with Representative Krieger that a determined adversary is going to be able to discover this information anyway. It's a fact of life in a modern environment. My hope is that the committee will consider trying to extend this slight additional protection both to assistant attorneys general and to deputy district attorneys. Finally, if you would like to consider a middle ground as far as assistant attorneys general, it might be possible to construct protections for simply those who are doing criminal functions. But my urging would be to include all assistant attorneys general. Finally, we'd be very happy to participate in the interim process. I agree with Mr. Gallagher's observation that amendments to the public records law grow kind of topsy-turvy. We're dealing with the 35th exemption to the 502 portion of the public records law, and that calls out for careful interim study.
Thank you, Mr. Shepard. Council Taylor.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a committee. Mr. Shepard, what are your feelings about amending 501 rather than 502, as Mr. Gallagher mentioned?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the difference, as Mr. Gallagher explained, I think, briefly to the committee, is that under 501, the exemptions require balancing of public interest versus public interest in disclosure versus the public interest in non-disclosure. And the fundamental policy choice you have to decide is whether you want to make that decision, fix that balancing by including it in 502 rather than leaving it to a case-by-case balancing in 501. And although I've not discussed this with other folks, frankly, that would be a step forward in and of itself if you were to add it to 501.
Thank you, Mr. Shepard.
Council Taylor, if I could, I think that the district attorneys would agree with Mr. Shepard's analysis. I don't think we're wedded to a 502 exemption. I think that what's noteworthy, though, is if in fact there's a request made under 501 and that request isn't granted, the appeal goes to the district attorney. And so, or it goes to the Department of Justice in the instance that it's a state appeal. And so it's a little bit oddball to have the district attorney making a decision about whether or not his or her own deputies are going to have their personal information relinquished. So in that sense, the 5021 seems to be, it removes that possibility of a conflict of interest.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. We have three other people who are signed up on House Bill 3407, and I'd like to have them come up together so we can move through those quickly. Mark Noakes, Bob Vroman, and James Morales. And gentlemen, I'll ask you to hold your remarks to no more, only a minute or two if you could, as we need to have a little discussion here in a public hearing to decide what direction to go with these bills. And Mr. Noakes.
Good morning, Representative McPherson, committee members. My name is Mark Noakes. I am the Linn County Assessor and also Tax Collector. I'm here today representing myself, of course, but also the Oregon State Association of County Assessors and Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors. The handout before you today should look very familiar. I was here a couple weeks ago in regards to 2847, and I will say that we have explored and have had discussions with various interested parties, and unfortunately, the associations I'm representing, we still haven't come to a conclusion that we think is any better than actually the a work group outside of the legislative session in the interim between all interested parties. Our point of view, plain and simple, is the administrative burden and associated costs that comes when change occurs or something new is added. I would say that assessors and tax collectors have gained efficiencies through electronic handling of most of our various functions. When change occurs, such as the legislature meets, and we are left with no alternative other than to manually handle change or pay for reprogramming of our existing programs. In either case, this is expensive. And for the record, this year of all years, many counties throughout the state are going into what I'll call a survival mode. And it is our hope, again, and I will reiterate this over and over again, that in the interim, a work group should be created in which all concerns could be raised at once, including those people who want their records to be non-disclosable, those who would have to do the redactions and absorb the costs, us. Those whose business interests rely upon records being complete and accurate. And I think since our last discussion a couple weeks ago, those people, the title companies and the real estate profession, have stepped up and are now recognizing the importance of open public records. And then lastly, those who can measure the value, if any, of going through all this trouble when so much information is already on the web. And that, I believe, is something that you've already had the discussion about today. And in closing, I would like to say that Linn County has had a policy. Every county has the option. People can have their records redacted currently by going through the county governing body. And I will entertain any questions.
Okay, let's go to Mr. Perlman here next.
Chairman McPherson, members of the board, my name is Bob Vroman. I'm the assessment and tax manager at Clackamas County, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors as well. I will take very little of your valuable time because you've heard a lot of good information today. What I will reiterate is that our organizations understand the need for the feeling of security and safety for our public safety people, district attorneys, and just in general, all of the citizens in our state. We handle an unbelievable amount of record, and that's what really brings us to some concerns. And that's why we're asking that we think there needs to be a well-thought-out systematic approach to what the legislature would like our records to look like and how it would impact our ability to do our business. And that's, again, why we're requesting that this be looked at in the interim because we're facing not only these groups, but there are other groups, medical professionals, that are asking that this type of information be removed from the public record. And at some point, it just gets down to we have to know how we can service the people that we do business with, the taxpayers. And to give you an example, 45,000 of the 162,000 accounts at Clackamas County, payments are actually made by tax services and mortgage lenders who are often looking for information to confirm the ownership, the names, and property identification of accounts that they service. And again, I'll be happy to respond to any questions. Our handout kind of outlines the concerns we have.
Let's hear from Mr. Morales.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, James Morales, representing the Association of County Clerks. I have provided the written testimony, and I hope you have a chance to read it. Just to get to some of the quick points rather than going through everything that's in the written testimony. Some of the statements earlier today, the form that was mentioned for redacting information, that is it for voter registration purposes, has been available for years where law enforcement officials and others can request that information be held confidential. And when a request for a voter list is made, that information is not included, those that have been requested to be made confidential. Now, for where this has happened in the past, there was some testimony that somebody accessed the county clerk's office, and that actually occurred through the county assessor's office, where the police officer experienced the individual that located his family through the assessment property records. Now, one of the pieces of the testimony I gave you, the next to the last paragraph, I mentioned really what we're hearing here, I believe, is putting the cart before the horse. I mean, if we can handle these types of situations up front rather than legislatively trying to take care of everybody who has the fear of being tracked down. Now, what can happen here is that individuals, police safety officers, medical professionals, district attorneys, can utilize their business address or where they work. They already know where you work. If you're prosecuting them, they know you work at the DA's office. If you're a police officer, they know that you work where you work. So you can utilize on these records that are recorded in our offices your business address with your employer's permission, I would suspect you'd want to get, to receive this type of correspondence, which would be when you record your deed, your mortgage, because we would think that these people would want to own property, correct? If you're going to hold it confidential, I can't imagine any bank that's going to want to give you a loan. I can't imagine anybody that's going to want to do any work on your home when they can't put a lien on your property if they're not paid. So what I'm saying is there's ways that these things can be done up front rather than coming back and trying to back things out that are just not back outable. And when I say not back outable, I'm talking about microfilm, all these things that I've already talked to you about. So that's one option. The other option is there's the ability for people to get an assumed business name in which they can put the record under this name rather than their own personal name and use their employer's address. So I would just like to point that out. The other reasons, of course,
Mr. Morales, we're really out of time. We've taken more time than we really should have on
this
bill.
So
I'm sorry.
Any questions?
Somebody else who just set up a note asking to speak, at this point we need to move on to other things. So if there are no questions for this panel, I'd like to excuse this panel, and then I want to use this. Leaving the public hearing open for a couple of minutes here in order to give some guidance to the folks who've been presenting to us. And we heard presentations really on two bills, 3407, which is the public hearing we were in, but also 2487, which is the 2847, which deals with district attorneys and deputy district attorneys. Although we had a request, we heard from Mr. Shepherd to expand that to attorneys at the Department of Justice. And then, of course, the public safety officers have asked for a version of an exemption. So the policy issue for us is, do we do as we were hearing from a number of witnesses, continue to study this issue to try to have a more comprehensive kind of and rational approach to it, or do we take these sort of individual cases brought forward to us of public safety officers and district attorneys, deputy district attorneys, and DOJ attorneys. So I think it would be helpful to them if we could, in some discussion, give an indication of where we would like them to head. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, would like to correct the record. The amendment in 2005 is in effect now. It does sunset in January, and after January, the language that I saw in the statute would revert to prior to the amendment. So my apologies to Mr. Gallagher for the startle there. Secondly, because this is such a broad-sweeping issue, and because I think that there are numerous areas that need to be addressed, I think this is one of those pieces that we look at that need to have a more fuller discussion and a work of the stakeholders here. And I would hope that the respective sponsors of these bills would agree that this is much broader than what we would be able to the problem is broader than what we would be able to cure with either of these bills. And I will just say very quickly also, I had the rare opportunity in a committee yesterday where the chair had brought a bill forward, but in conversations with the governor's office and another agency, has been able to get that very thing accomplished by virtue of conversation and working to resolve the issue. I wish we could do more of that in this building, and I think this is one of those issues that would be very ripe for that work to be undertaken in the interim.
Any other comments from the committee?
The only thing I'd say is some of those groups have met before. The police groups met with the clerks and so on to try to get that resolved. We thought they had it resolved, and now we're back to square one again.
Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, this is really emotional for me. I'm sitting here
thinking about all the protection we're trying to provide for people, and I looked at Representative Krieger, and I said, you got some trees. This is a symptom of a much larger problem. And I want to help protect those that help protect us. But for somebody to make a threat like they've made, I'm going to be quiet, but this is just a huge, and I don't know what the solution is. Reason, obviously, people can't get together and come up with a solution because there is no solution, because we have a sick society and there's a lack of respect for authority, and this goes way broader than any individual protection here. So whatever you want to do, I'll help.
The only other thing I'd say is possibly I talked with Mr. Snyder last week on a fee schedule to pay for it. Because, for example, I never had my phone number. I always had a listed phone number, which most police don't. So I wasn't worried about that. But if somebody did and they wanted to have this extra thing, maybe they could pay the county a fee and then to cover the cost of them redacting the name.
Well, then, my plan to close the public hearing on House Bill 3407, not go to work session on that bill or on 2847. I will roll those over for work session to the next agenda. That gives an opportunity for further offline discussions about what, if anything, might be crafted. It does seem to me that there should be, if we're going to move something, it should be something that at least addresses the groups that have been brought forward to us together in the same way. We shouldn't be doing separate bills that are one-off for each one. I'd say it would still be helpful to have some offline discussion with my committee members about whether to even proceed with that as an or the alternative of more study, which, as we know too often in this building, is sort of a cover for inaction. Okay, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3407 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2334.
In here somewhere.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, House Bill 2334 modifies and expands the requirement for concealed handgun licenses. And I'll be addressing the -2 amendments, which are the ones that should be under consideration today. ORS 166.291 lists requirements relating to the issuance of concealed handgun licenses. These requirements include, but are not limited to, person being a U.S. citizen, at least 21 years of age, completed certain firearm safety-related courses, has never been convicted of a felony, and has not been convicted of a misdemeanor within the prior 4 years. There are a number of other requirements, but that's a summary. House Bill 2334 does a number of things. One thing that it does is it adds three prohibitions to that list. First of all, it states that the person must not be required to register as a sex offender in any state. Secondly, that the person has not received a dishonorable discharge from the armed forces of the United States. And the other prohibition is that the person has not been convicted of an offense involving controlled substances or participated in a court-supervised drug diversion program. This third provision includes any controlled substance felony or misdemeanor offense. It also includes the violation of possession of less than an ounce of marijuana. However, for that violation, to act as a prohibition on the person being able to get a concealed handgun license, the person needs two violations of possession of less than an ounce of marijuana, or they need one violation and participation in a court-supervised drug diversion program under ORS 135.907. That is a specific drug diversion program that relates to the offense of marijuana. In sum, this provision about no controlled substance offenses is any felony, any misdemeanor involving controlled substances, or with regard to marijuana that you have two. That's the summary of what that provision does. House Bill 2334 does a number of other things. It defines county residents for purposes of applying for concealed weapons permits, which those are handled by the county sheriff. The bill amends ORS 166.295 to allow active members of the armed forces, the National Guard of the United States, or the Oregon National Guard to renew their concealed handgun license applications by mail.
Thank you, Council. Representative Olson, thank you for your patience after we said we were going to be going to your bill. It took a lot longer to get to it.
than we can imagine.
That's good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Andy Olson. I'm the state representative from the Albany area. And I'm just, this is going to be very quick. If you recall, Mr. Chair, you and three members of your committee, basically we heard this last session for the CHL in a little different version, and felt that we were extremely close to getting it completed, and it just didn't happen last session. So during the interim, Representative Krieger asked me, actually I should say directed me, to get together with the members from the gun rights advocates as well as for the Sheriff's Association to look into this a little bit more. There was two main issues that we dealt with from the bill that we had introduced two years ago. One was the principal residency thing, and Mr. Stanford has already addressed that issue, which is identified now in the principal residence on page 5, section 2, sub 9. And that language that's described there actually was taken from the language that years ago the voters voted on that dealt with death with dignity. So we're consistent with that for the description of what principal residency is. Excuse me. Second thing that we were concerned about and which we have addressed as well was also just below subsection 9 on page 5 was subsection 10. And that dealt with the description of what basically an officer would use as a report for addiction. As you can tell, that has been removed, and it's been replaced with the dash twos now that fits nicely into page 2 of the bill. Excuse me, page 3. At this point right now, this is, I feel extremely comfortable with this bill. It's there's been an extreme amount of work with it. Met several times during the interim with the sheriffs as well as with the advocates of guns. And this is what we have, and there is an agreement with the dash twos.
So. Thank you, Representative Olson. Any questions?
Thanks for all your work.
Yeah, we do appreciate your hard work on this.
Thank you.
This is heavy duty. Okay, then Elmer Dickens, Washington County Council.
Chair McPherson, committee members, I'm Elmer Dickens. I'm the Senior Assistant County Counsel for Washington County. I also serve as an instructor for the Oregon State Sheriff's Association Civil Process Schools, which means that I go and teach the people that actually do this work on the ground every 6 months in a class. And talk about that for a couple days, CHL among other things. Just saw the dash two amendments this morning, and as you remember, for those of you who were on the committee last year, I was here during last session testifying about this. I'll make three quick points. I do support the amendments as written. From the perspective of the people that do this on the ground, this is a shall issue state, and the most important thing for them to know, the clerks that are doing this, is when should we issue? And the problems that we have with people that don't get CHLs, and a lot of times is it's open to question. The thing I like about the dash two amendments is it closes some of those questions. For instance, has not received a dishonorable discharge. That's a yes or a no. Clerk go through and say, yep, that's a yes. You don't get one. Not required to register as a sex offender. That's a yes and no. The previous amendment said unlawful user. That comes directly from federal law. And that, quite frankly, opens up a Pandora's box because the Ninth Circuit language is very broad. The dash two amendments now lets us say this offense either meets it or it doesn't, and it also exempts a very minor marijuana offense. So those are great from the perspective of the people that are doing these. So the only other thing I would add is that the military renewal by mail seems like a very common sense thing, and I can't imagine why anybody would oppose that. Thank you for your time.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Dickens. Any questions? If not, next, Kevin Sterrett.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. We're fine with this as amended. The only thing I'd like to bring up, which I don't think needs to be dealt with here, I've discussed this with the sponsor, was the residency requirements you see on page 5, line 26. call for an Oregon driver's license, and I think I'd like it to also allow for an Oregon ID card for people who don't drive. Other than that, the Dash 2 amendments have addressed all the concerns we've had with this bill for several years, and we can support it as is.
Very good.
Hey!
Thank you, Mr. Sterrett. Rod Harder.
Mr. Chair, I'm members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rod Harder with the National Rifle Association. This has been a long process, and we all remember the blow-up we had at the end of last session. I'm here to support the Dash 2 amendments as written. I was a little confused over the marijuana wording that came out in the Dash 2s this morning. However, counsel explained it very well, both to me and to you. So we're here to support the amendments. I think it makes things very clear, and there are some things in it for everyone. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Cameron.
Maybe Mr. Harder, what does somebody have to do? Can you give me an example to receive a dishonorable discharge from the armed forces, which would make them ineligible for a concealed permit now in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, it would be something similar to a major felony. It runs from desertion to collaboration with the enemy, to murder. It's all major felonies in order to get a discharge. It is the worst discharge you can get.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Krieger.
Not really a question, but I just wanted to make sure counsel and people realize Darian had to put up with me in his office. I don't know how many days and how many times he thought he had it right. I told him he had it wrong. And we kept going and kept going, but that's how good legislation comes about, is keep wordsmithing, keep talking, keep having that cup of coffee and working on it with the interest party. So I really appreciate the work you did, Darian.
I don't recall getting any coffee, but thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Harder.
Was he back?
With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2334 and open a work session on House Bill 2334.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
I'd like to move the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2334.
Representative Krieger moves the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2334. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Dash 2 amendments are in the bill.
I'd like to move House Bill 2334 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2334 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Warren.
Aye.
Representative
Hawk.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative
Barker. Aye.
Vice Chair
Wilson. Aye.
Chairman Corson.
Aye.
House Bill 2334 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Krieger, would you like to carry that, or should you invite Representative Olson?
Olson. He's worked on it for a year and a half.
Very good. Thank you very much. Well, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2334. Okay, I'll open a work session on House Bill 2737.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, House Bill 2737 relates to the crime of assault in the third degree and driving under the influence of intoxicants. ORS 163.165 establishes the C felony of assault in the third degree. This offense occurs in several situations, some of which include: 1, recklessly causing serious physical injury to someone by means of a deadly or dangerous weapon, or through circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to human life; 2, while being helped by someone else, causing physical injury to someone; or 3, causing physical injury to an emergency medical technician performing her job, to a child 10 or younger, to a taxi cab driver in the scope of employment. House Bill 2737 adds a new category for the felony of assault in the third degree: if the defendant causes the injury through driving a vehicle while under the influence of intoxicants. This offense is classified as a level 8 on the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission sentencing guideline grid, and it also makes clear that a Dewey assault in the third degree is a Class B felony rather than a Class C felony.
And there are no amendments that are called to this bill.
No amendments.
And this, and with a subsequent two ways and means.
Correct.
So, committee, this is another one of our driving of the influence bills. It does have a fiscal impact, but it reflects a policy that I think we sensed was pretty important. This looks like something that I can move out.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2737 to the floor with the due pass. Well, Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2737 with the due pass recommendation to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means for prior reference. Any discussion of the motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative
Henry. Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Lawrence.
Aye.
Representative
Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Aye. Vice
Chair Whitman.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2737 moves with a due pass recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means. I close the work session on House Bill 2737. And now with a changing of the guard, Council will be taking up next a public hearing on House Bill 3241. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3241.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3241 creates new statutes of repose for actions based on construction defects. ORS 12.135 provides that an action against a person arising from the design, construction, alteration, or repair of any improvement to real property must be commenced within 10 years from, quote, substantial completion or abandonment of the construction. House Bill 3241 would amend the statute of repose depending on the type of project being constructed or repaired. It would provide that a 10-year statute of repose for a, quote, small commercial structure or residential structure, and a 6-year statute of repose for a large commercial structure.
And we have several witnesses signed up on this bill. Jessica Adamson, Mark, can't read all. Jessica, bring your panel up. Can't read all the writing here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson with Associated General Contractors, and my apologies for my poor handwriting this morning. We're pleased that this committee is hearing House Bill 3241, which is a piece of legislation that was brought together really in a package of bills, the other piece of which is in the House Consumer Protection Committee. But this piece of legislation should look vaguely familiar. It was here last session, yet in a broader form. What this bill does is for large commercial projects, which if you have the handout on page 2, there's a set of three boxes there in the chart. For large commercial projects would reduce the statute of ultimate repose from 10 years to 6 years for only those projects. We spent the interim after working with Representative Ackerman last session to pass a statute of repose bill that would have reduced from 10 years to 6 years the statute of repose for all forms of construction. After working that bill last session, we went back to the drawing board and looked at licensure and at liability as one major package, and again brought forward a series of two bills, and talk about 3242 in combination with that, because it really is. What we tried to do is say, let's raise the standard of practice in the commercial side of the industry. Let's add some owner protections, including a 2-year warranty. Let's add a continuing education so we can identify problems, prevent problems, continuously improve the construction industry. And then let's continue to have the dialogue and move forward with sharing in a business-to-business environment, which is what large commercial construction is. In that business-to-business environment, sharing that that responsibility with our owners. The reality of the way the law works today, there is a 10-year statute of repose, but there is a 6-year statute of limitations. So for the original owner of these large commercial projects, life doesn't change for them. They have 6 years today to bring a breach of contract claim. And so this legislation would not change those conditions for those folks. It would, however, limit to 6 years claims for secondary owners. Here today with me are Mark Gerba with the firm of Smith, Fried, and Emmerhard to kind of give a legal perspective, and Mr. Pat O'Brien with O'Brien Constructors, a contractor that does extensive work in the commercial market, to explain this from a contractor perspective.
Go ahead.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Mark Gerba. I'm a lawyer in Portland, Oregon. I represent typically general contractors in construction defect litigation, commercial projects. Some of the claims I'm defending now are related to apartments, hotels, large-scale apartments, hotels, and other commercial structures. What I've found is that we have some inconsistent rulings by both arbitrators and judges because of the way the statute's presently drafted, the statute of repose. If you read it, 6 years statute limitation after it commences should allow the contractors, if they negotiate with the owner, to walk away from a project and know that they do not face any additional liability. In fact, if you read the AIA and AGC forms, they have a statutory commencement section in them that says once substantial completion's done, the statute commences. Therefore, 6 years later, all statute of limitations related to breach of contract should be done and over with. However, by the reading of 12.135 the way it is now, I've seen judges as well as arbitrators rule that it's really a 10-year statute. And I've seen, despite the agreement among sophisticated builders and owners, claims surviving up to 10 years. In fact, I have noticed in the last month of a commercial owner doing an investigation in year 9, and which may result in litigation before the 10 years is up. Now, the problem with having litigation between years 7 and 10, outside of the fact that it's outside of when the parties contracted to limit their exposure, is that you lose job files, witnesses, their memories fade, the laborers and companies and subcontractors may not be available. In short, and also because of poor maintenance potentially, I would argue that anybody that's waiting to the year 9 to bring a claim has waited on maintenance as well. You're going to have a higher cost to repair and less certainty as to who the responsible parties are. This increases the transaction cost and increases the number of parties that are ultimately brought in. And what you're going to have is, like I saw last summer, a case last 5 weeks in Washington County Court on a construction defect claim. This is a inefficient use of judicial resources, especially when you have sophisticated parties contracting with each other. I would also like to point out that this would put us on par with Washington. Washington has a 6-year statute of repose for all construction claims and, in fact, recognizes some of the issues I raised with regard to witnesses and job files and such. And if you have an oral contract, the statute of limitations is 3 years. So this would put us on par with our neighboring state and be an efficient use of judicial resources and also achieve what the parties actually contract to achieve in terms of limitations and exposures. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gerba. Next.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Pat O'Brien. I'm a building contractor from Portland, Oregon, and I'd like to point out a few things that are a little bit redundant. Mark has already pointed out many of my points. So I'd like to suggest that the change that we're proposing is a matter of fairness, accountability, quality improvement, and cost reduction. From a fairness standpoint, it'll put the contractor on a better footing from a timing perspective, particularly since architects and engineers enjoy a statute of limitations of 2 years, and adjoining states certainly have 6-year statute of limitations. We would certainly like to be in that same category. From accountability, commercial construction is driven by contract law. We feel very strongly that we need to get back to that contract, and I think that everybody on the same page as far as timing is concerned will allow us all to come to the table in good faith to try to deal with latent defect issues. And from a quality improvement and cost reduction, I think we're all aware that insurance costs are skyrocketing to the point that small commercial contractors are being excluded from the building market because they cannot secure insurance, period. One example is, of course, that major insurance carriers in a state like Oregon will look at premium paid, no matter whether it's general liability, completed operations, workers' compensation, it doesn't matter. They're bundling their insurance premiums and are looking for a bare minimum limit of $1 million before they'll insure small contractors. And I think we could all understand that $1 million premium paid into an insurance company is quite a large amount of work, therefore excluding the small contractor as a result of some of the difficulties created by latent defect. As far as quality improvement, insurance companies are requiring that certain projects be brought to a level of construction that demands water management and will address a lot of the construction issues that we have seen develop over the last 10 years. I'm very, very impressed and pleased with a lot of the improvements made in technology that have allowed us to hopefully build our projects in a much more quality manner. And as Mark had pointed out, I think the one thing that a 6-year statute of repose would do is bring the problem to the front earlier. Waiting until 9.5 years to file a claim just adds to the confusion and the unfairness of the resolution, and we feel that at 6 years we'll have a much better chance of understanding what the problems are, dealing with them, and equitably distributing the responsibility. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you again for the opportunity to present this bill. Again, this bill will deal with large commercial owners. These are sophisticated owners who involve their attorneys, and we involve our attorneys, and these are contracts that are 30 to 400 pages in length and specifications that are quite lengthy. These are not transactions between contractors and individual homeowners. These are situations where, from a contractor perspective, the owner has the upper hand and the contractor is working to negotiate off a contract we're handed, as opposed to the other way around. We are really, it's a very, very big difference between a business-to-consumer relationship, which is the residential industry, and the business-to-business relationship, which is the commercial industry. We have tailored both this bill and 3242 to address the commercial industry, where the residential folks will remain where they are, the residential owners and the small commercial owners will stay in that 10-year time frame, and we would change the situation for a business-to-business environment, which we believe is appropriate.
Thank you, Ms. Adamson. And we have
Chair. Just a real quick question. I noticed in the testimony that we are bringing ourselves in line with Washington and Idaho. Is the statute the same for the small construction and residential? Are we on the same level today with Oregon and Washington? 10 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, the statute of ultimate repose in Oregon is 10 years across the board, whether it's residential, small commercial, or large commercial. In Washington and Idaho, it is 6 years across the board for all construction.
Just to clarify then, so we're only bringing in large construction projects to compete with our neighboring states, and we're leaving small construction projects at 10 years when our neighbors are at 6 years. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, yes, that is accurate.
Can I ask why?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, many of the concerns that we heard last session dealt with the concern of an individual homeowner or a small business owner, essentially a mom and pop corner grocery store is under 4,000 square feet, and the fact that those folks aren't as sophisticated a buyer and should be afforded more time to bring these claims. Our bill last session did not do that, but as we spent the interim working on this issue and looking at how can we raised the standard of practice, and the commercial side of the industry raised the bar, so to speak, provide more protections. We felt that it was appropriate, as we dealt with our sector of the industry, to try and make this change along with it. We don't affect the residential industry in our license reform piece. And again, in deference to the concerns that we heard the last go around, we felt it was appropriate to leave those folks at 10 years.
Thank you.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Currently, how many of construction defect claims, and I don't need specific numbers, just in general, are brought between the 6 and 10 year period? I mean, how many? What percentage of claims are actually brought after 6 years but before 10 years currently?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, I have not seen any stats for claims generally. I went through and looked at my files, and I looked at the six big claims I'm working on right now. They're between $1.5 and $10 million large commercial claims. All of them have been brought within 6 years. So generally speaking, I don't think this would have, at least on my practice, a big effect on most of the claims. I did mention I have another one that just came in to my office, which is a 9-year claim. That's more the exception. That's going to be far more difficult. These ones that come within 6 years, I'm actually able to get job files, maintenance records, and such a little easier because there's probably only one owner. So for speaking on my behalf, for my practice, I would say it's a small percentage, and it would get rid of the small percentage of the claims that take up too much time.
Thank you. And a brief follow-up. Mm-hmm. And the claim that you're looking at that you said arose 9 years, what type of claim is that?
That is a aquatic center for a community outside of Portland, Oregon. And apparently there is a leak around a window, and that's all I know at this point. We're going to do some investigation. My view when I first hear that is there must be some maintenance that wasn't done if there is a leak right now. But I have to face the reality that there may be a lawsuit just because it's at 10 years. I would think that at 5 years, these other owners in these cases have done, they would look at the structure at 5 years and make those complaints at 5 years rather than at 9 years. It's obviously not a big issue and probably maintenance, but I'm speaking without knowing all the facts. So I haven't done the investigation, and frankly, I don't know if I'll be able to find. I understand one of the subcontractors in that case is no longer in business. That's going to make my job incredibly difficult in terms of tendering to the potentially responsible party if there is, in fact, a real issue.
Thank you.
There are no further questions, then excuse this panel. And we have Steve Mullaney.
Mr. Chair, unfortunately, he had to leave to get to a meeting with his client.
Apologize for our agenda having got crowded out one of your speakers, Ms. Adamson. Bob Shiprack.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary of the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. Jessica and I have introduced two labor management bills this session, and I'm here to speak on behalf of this particular piece of legislation, and I'll be very brief because the previous panels hit most of the high points. But in the large commercial sector of the industry, and we've been encouraging these contractors for some time to try and step up and get divorced from some of the other parts of the industry, and these two bills will do that. They're much different in that on the large commercial projects, which most of my members work on, you've got a high degree of apprenticeship utilization on these projects, pretty well-trained people. The other thing that strikes me, and Pat kind of touched on it, was I also see this as a fairness issue because the people that design these buildings have a much lower statute of repose or whatever it is, I'm not an attorney, than the actual builders. So you could have, in fact, design flaws that were engineered or architect put into the building that would be installed, and yet the contractor is therefore much more liable than even the person that designed the building. So for a number of reasons, we support this legislation, and hope that you'll feel free to act on it in a favorable fashion.
Very good.
Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Shipwright.
Thank you.
Those are the last of the witnesses on this bill. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 5241. Representative Nelson has been waiting very patiently for with us. Well, and I've received word that the House Bill 3176, the amendments appear to be acceptable to the people who have been looking at them, so I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 3176.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm passing out an amendment that was put together out in the hallway. I understand the basic agreement. Briefly and discuss it with the parties in the hallway. And the primary difference between this and the Dash 2 amendments that you have before you is, if you look, it adds a subsection A at the beginning: a search warrant has been issued authorizing the tracking of a mobile tracking device. Other than that, it's exactly the same as the amendment that the Dash 2 that are before us on. And
what section is affected by the Dash 3?
Excuse me, I had my amendments a while ago. I can't. But the only change, when I look at it and I discuss it with the parties, as you see up here, a search warrant has been issued authorizing a tracking device. So you have three sections under two, A, B, and C. A search warrant, the owner of the vehicle consents. The law enforcement agency has reasonable grounds to believe that a life-threatening emergency exists, and locating the vehicle is necessary to two. A, prevent serious harm, render aid, locate missing person. B, law enforcement has probable cause to believe the crime has been about to be committed.
It adds a search warrant component.
It adds a search
warrant. These are alternative. That is, A through D are each different branches by which the search would be. The location of the vehicle would be permitted. Representative Bonamici, we realize that you didn't get the benefit of the hearing we held earlier today on this bill. What was identified was that there were concerns about the constitutionality of the original bill as printed because of the location of that vehicle constituting, in effect, a search. And the Dash 2s were brought forward. Had been prepared in order to cure that issue. There were some concerns about whether they really did the job or not. So we have now the amendment, which I gather is not from the Legislative Council, so it's in the nature of a conceptual amendment. Is that
Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. It is in the nature of a conceptual amendment. And needless to say, it's a fairly concise conceptual amendment with a fairly small change.
And the only difference is the insertion from the Dash 2s is the insertion of the of lowercase a and then the relettering of the following.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
And Mr. Chair and Council, just for clarification, at capital letter print C, locating missing person, semicolon, or would mean that all of a, small b, small c, and small the following small d can be independent, and they do not have to work collectively. Just for clarity and for purposes of interpretation, as if each subparagraph small letter would have an or after it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, members of the committee, it would be two options. You could, I guess, suspend the rules and adopt the conceptual amendment, or we could adopt the Dash 2, and then when it goes to the Senate side, insert the subsection A. I know the parties are amenable to that, so that would be the choices.
Ordinarily, it's preferable not to suspend the rules due to a conceptual amendment, but we have the text of it out in front of us here, and it has been vetted, so I'm willing to do the conceptual amendment. So what I would invite is a motion to adopt the, as a conceptual amendment, the proposed amendment to House Bill 3176 that we've each been presented here today.
Okay, Mr. Chair, move we suspend the rules and accept the conceptual amendment that we have before us for House Bill 3176.
Representative Barker moves that we suspend the rules and adopt the conceptual amendment labeled Proposed Amendment to House Bill 3176 that you see before you. Is there any discussion of that motion? Any objection? Then the conceptual amendment is in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3176 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 3176 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I have a question, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I missed the earlier part of the hearing. Was there a discussion about the amount of the civil penalty? Was that filled in? It's online.
Good question. There was not a discussion of that point. And I know that you draw our attention to it, Representative. I see that
I'd still go ahead and move it up to the Senate side.
You could move it along to have that filled in. Ms. Meyer, do you have a suggestion?
Chair McPherson, Andrew Meyer, ACLU of Oregon. Just because you're moving quickly on things, I want you to know that Kevin Campbell was here. He represents the company. I think he does have issues about liability and civil penalty, and I believe those hopefully be addressed. I don't have answers for you, but I just want to alert you, at least outside of the room, it was discussed somewhat, but I think people are trying to still maybe work on those things, and I have no, we'd certainly be concerned about the tie-ins, but I'll leave it at that at this point.
Well, committee, there our choice is, do we move it along with the blank in for the civil penalty, because we're late in our process and need to get things moved, or do we
move it. Let's move it out.
Okay. Well, I see it seems to be a shaping consensus for...
I have a procedural question. Then what happens? Who fills in the blank?
Set aside. Set aside.
No, they'll work
and then
the
we
Senate
confer. You could fill it in now if you want. Or if somebody has an idea, such suggestion as to what gets filled in.
Well, let's throw something out there.
I think I would maybe defer to a process that
is
a little more.
The proponents isn't here.
Right. Yeah.
Concerned about it.
I think I prefer to leave it blank than to put something that just seems like on a hunch. Yeah. It seems like us is what's going to happen anyway. Or we could roll it over to another day and bring it back.
Yeah. Let's go ahead. Let's get it out of here.
Okay. Okay. Well, there's sides.
Mr. Chair, has Representative Nelson had conversation or about the civil penalty civil amount? Penalty. Was there any discussion as you were preparing this?
And if you haven't, a no would be sufficient, Representative Nelson.
A no would be sufficient. Well, unfortunately, this comes up, as you know, Representative Chair McPherson and Representative Flores many times, and everybody always says $1,000. So I don't know the basis, and I don't know what we would want to put for sure in that. Of course, it can always be changed.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have a motion before us to move the bill, including the blank, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. So it's maybe not the best form of lawmaking, but there we are. Any further discussion? If not,
I would like to talk about the $1,000 rather than move it with the blank.
Mr. Chair. We can put the $1,000 in, and on the other side, if that's not agreeable, they can change it.
Is that a motion to conceptually amend the bill to
ensure... Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion to conceptually amend the bill to fill the blank in with $1,000.
Including a suspension of the rules permitting a conceptual amendment. Representative Cameron moves to suspend the rules to permit a conceptual amendment and to amend line 24... and fill the blank with $1,000. Is there any discussion of that motion?
Representative Chair McPherson, my only comment is my own preference is to leave it blank because I don't have a clue. And arbitrarily put the $1,000 in there as stated, but I'm just uncomfortable. So we can certainly vote on the motion.
On the other side of that discussion, Mr. Chair, if we're going to allow the blank to be filled in on the Senate side, we can certainly allow the figure to be adjusted on the Senate side as well.
I feel more comfortable filling it in. And one low jack costs like $700. So I am comfortable with $1,000. So.
Okay. Any further discussion of the motion, which was to suspend the rules to insert the $1,000 as the civil penalty? Any objection to the motion? Then the bill is further conceptually amended by inserting $1,000 in line 24 in the blank.
And in my motion, I'll amend it to accept that.
And Representative Barker, he renews his, he withdraws his prior motion and now moves that we, House Bill 3176 to the floor with a do pass recommendation as amended by the conceptual amendments previously stated. Any discussion of that motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Tom.
Aye.
Representative
Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Dave.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wiedemann.
Excused.
Chair
McQuiston. Aye. House Bill 3176 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Nelson, would you carry that bill? Very good. Thank you. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3176. Question for some members of our committee. We have two public hearings that were set, including one that was going to open 2553. So I understand there's a commitment for some of the committee members at 10 a.m. Shall we roll those over then to the next agenda? Okay, we have completed as much. We can't, unfortunately, it's actually 7 a.m. on Friday, committee, but because we were timely in getting a notice out for that, but we are not timely. Because I've received some resistance to the just announced 7 a.m. for without giving 48 hours notice.
Oh.
So it is 7 a.m. on Friday, but it will be 8 a.m. tomorrow. We conclude our last business. I'm just going to announce it's being rolled over. We are going to be rolling over to our next agenda, the work sessions on House Bill 2909, 3407. 2847, 3241, 2310, 2448, and rolling over the public hearing and possible work session on House Bills 2553 and 2554. That concludes as much of our agenda as we can finish. Committee and staff, thank you very much. We're adjourned.